This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We are rolling. This is the Luke and the Pete Show. I'm the Luke bit of this particular situation, and I'm talking to the Pete bit of the particular situation. I'm not really. I'm Pete. Hello, Luke. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. And I just think I can't help but feel that when you mix us our names up like that, you are benefiting from that.
Well, Vish, when we were on the Football Ramble yesterday, Vish called me Luke.
He called you me, didn't he? Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
I've already firmly implanted myself into his subconscious. Good stuff.
Exactly.
A good start.
Yeah. He sees you as an authority figure. He's looking around the room. He sees Marcus. He looks at me. Where are the people who know their stuff, he's thinking? I'm going to pretend Pete's Luke for a bit.
Where's that bully that I found vaguely annoying, is what he's thinking.
Oh, man. It's been such a busy week since we recorded on Monday. There are so many things happening that I have poorly researched. I basically just went to a website. There has been a palm-sized lump of rock falling from the sky into Rajasthan, northern India, and it's made of germanium, platinum, nickel, and iron. Nobody knows where it's come from. I mean, it's obviously just, you know, some kind of meteorite, but it looks all smooth and it looks like it's got an eyeball. It's really, really interesting. So, yeah.
Where's it come from? It's come from space, is it?
The sky. Yeah, I think it just fell from the sky. But I'd be annoyed if I was even anywhere close to that falling, because that is, I'm going to use my favourite term, indicative of a wider problem. I'm going to get hit by lightning or something.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the... I mean, apparently, I've got it in front of you now, right? National Geographic have done an article saying the chances of you being hit by a meteorite are... Let's have a
but
look.
Still they come. But still they come.
The problem with National Geographic is that it's just... Listen, mate, I don't need 18 paragraphs. Just tell me the numbers.
Stop showing us pictures.
Apparently... The lifetime odds of dying from a local meteorite, asteroid or comet impact are 1 in 1.6 million, which, by the way, doesn't seem that big.
No. What's the lottery? The lottery must be lower than that, surely.
Do you want some perspective?
I would like some perspective.
You've got a 1 in 90 chance of being killed in a car accident,
right.
1 in 250 for a fire, 1 in 60,000 for a tornado. Of course, I imagine all these depend on exactly where you live. Because you ain't dying from a tornado in the UK. 1 in 135,000 for lightning. 1 in 8 million for a shark attack. Again, I live in West Norwood. That's not happening. Or 1 in 195 million for winning the Powerball lottery. I think this is an American article, so that'll be for... broadly speaking, for the US. So,
yeah.
I mean, you're basically a little bit more likely to be death by lightning and much, much less likely to be bitten by a shark and killed.
If you're kind of driving towards a tornado in a car, who wins there? Did the tornado kill you? Did the car kill you? Was it a combination of both?
Yeah.
What are the odds there?
It's a good question. I mean, and then, of course, poor old Bill Paxton, who immediately comes to mind when you mention... Twister, which is essentially what your inspiration for that making that point was, right?
I was just literally thinking about driving a car into a tornado. I can't drive, but I don't think it's really important in that particular situation.
Poor old Bill Paxton passed away from a stroke, sadly. So he spent all that time chasing tornadoes.
Tornado and, related, did
or? Yeah, it wasn't really a tornado thing. No, I got him in the end. Great movie, that, by the way. I remember being a young kid going to watch that at the cinema and having my mind blown to bits. Now, people talk a lot about Jurassic Park as a kid and that how good that was. And we've talked about that recently on here, saying that, you know, the special effects still look amazing and it's a masterfully done movie for lots of different reasons, and everyone knows that. But I tell you what, Twister doesn't get any love. And Twister blew my mind to bits when I was a kid.
Well, I think Twister kind of was a victim of its own success, because nobody needs to make any more films about Twisters. Because it was good. It happened. So, like, if you're a Hollywood executive, let's make another film about Twisters. It's like, well, we've got one. And it was good. And Bill Paxton was in it. So
at what point,
don't worry
though, Pete,
about
do
it.
They say, do they say, yeah, but that was 1996? I mean, one thing I would say to those particular film producers and the money men who can have the power to green light such a
the
movie
suits.
Is say the budget for it was $90 million. It made $500 million. Directed by Jan de Bont as well.
Right. What did he do after that? I'm not a big film guy.
That it was his second film after Speed. Speed was one of his movies.
Oh, that's good. That's a good hit, right, isn't it?
Yeah. And he also did Speed 2 Cruise Control, and then it went south. Before you know it, you're making Lara Croft Tomb Raider.
That wasn't bad.
But it's a good movie, Twister. I rate it. I think we could be. But my problem, Pete, with this would be, would you now be in a situation where the special effects would be so heavily relied upon that we wouldn't have that magic? Because we've all seen Sharknado.
We have, yeah. I think that had a very low budget, though, to be fair. I think the shark and the Nado, it was very cheap, very affordable.
I think you're very much kind of. What am I saying? You're very much kind of limiting the pool of willing investors when you present a film called Sharknado.
Yeah. You're talking to people who are very interested in money laundering and tax write-offs. I think that's the that's very much the producers you're talking to on that one.
These are the two main sources of funding we're going for this movie, okay?
Exactly.
I think they made about five of them, though, so.
Oh, well, there you go.
But the thing is, Pete, right, actually, I think I'm also going to just jump in there and say, I don't know if that's the full picture there, because isn't there a little kind of boutique industry around a certain production company that's MO is essentially just to make 150 films a year for a really cheap budget and hope like a few of them cross over and be cult hits. And and that's how they kind of, that's the kind of their business model. So there are a load of people who are making films like that cheap. I forget the name of the production company now, but it might have been one of those, maybe.
I think, is it Uwe Boll? He does a lot of video, he certainly used to do a lot of video game movies, and he would buy, or his company, or whoever was funding them, would buy these very, very, very popular video games, the licenses very cheaply, and make really cheap, crappy films out of them. But he that was very much his style of filmmaking. He would use cheap licenses. And I don't think they were that unsuccessful, because if you really like a video game, lots, and there's no more video game out there, you know, you're probably going to go and watch the film, however bad it is, really.
Yeah, true. This Sharknado was a sci-fi. Remember the sci-fi channel?
Right, okay.
It's like a straight to TV made for the sci-fi channel one. But there is a film company. Do you know what? I think it might be the one who made Paranormal Activity.
That was a hit, though, wasn't it?
Exactly right. So they that's what they do. They go for like really cheap type movies, and then Blumhouse. That's what it's called. Yeah, it is then Blumhouse. So they make mainly low budget horror films, and then hope a load of them cross over. So they made Paranormal Activity. They made Insidious. I think they started to branch out a little bit more. I think they might have even made Get Out as well.
Really? Is that? Yeah. Wow. Well.
Anyway, that's their model.
Had a hit on their hands there.
Speaking of horror films, though, I watched Hereditary earlier this week.
Which one is Hereditary? Am I going to have to write that down now?
So it's by Ari Aster, the same guy who made Midsommar. Now, I watched Midsommar and I really, really enjoyed it. But I never got around to seeing Hereditary. Although it was kind of billed as being this amazing horror movie. It's got Toni Collette in it. Yeah, it's got...
She's just getting better and better, Toni Collette. She was always excellent, but she's just so good.
Oh my God, she's so good in it. Do you know what? I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I thought it was quite frightening, particularly the last kind of act. I don't think it was as good as Midsommar personally, but that's possibly because I saw Midsommar first. But one thing I would say, Pete, is that Toni Collette is amazing in Hereditary. Like, she's so, so good. She's an excellent actor anyway, but she's brilliant in that. And I kind of wonder why it is that, and it happens sort of with comedy films as well, why horror movie acting performances are sort of overlooked when it comes to award season. They're not really seen as being worthy, are they?
Mm. Well, it's like, Get Out was a really good example. Obviously, it won a lot of awards, but it was, horror is like a dirty kind of, it's seen as cheap and like, you know, doing things cheaply and the devices are very hack. Same with zombie films and stuff like that. There's very few zombie films that sort of break through. But they'll have their time in the sun again. Horror's definitely back in a big way.
You don't really see many horror films nominated for Oscars and stuff, do you? Not that matters, I guess.
No, but I think it will get better. I think you could, but I think it's classification. I think films don't want to be classified as horror because of that they have that kind of they have the stench of horror around them, and nobody wants to give them awards. I mean, you would probably classify Parasite as being, you know, a pretty stand up horror film in many ways, but it's obviously not. It obviously wasn't pitched as that. It was this kind of
I thought that was
a thriller. Excellent. Yeah, because it was wonderful, and looking at Chris Tilley, who does our Stakhanov production Clash of the Titles with Alex Zane and Vicky Crompton, he goes to Fright Fest every year, and every year in Leicester Square for a week. There's just a lot of like viewing houses just given over completely to horror films, and I've been to a couple of screenings, and there's some really good stuff out there with really good directors, competent acting. And I think the accessibility of semi-pro filming equipment and lighting and things like that has really revolutionized indie filmmaking. The problem is there's just too much to bloody watch, isn't there? But, you know, obviously Netflix and Amazon are obviously helping with that.
Yeah, there's way too many films these days for sure. But Pete, I was going to say, the reason I bring it up is because Toni Collette in that movie, I mean, I don't want to give it away in case anyone's not seen it, but she's essentially a mother of a family kind of managing her way as best she can through like a series of different sort of family tragedies, and there's mental health aspects to it and lots of different things going on. And I was just thinking as I was watching it, I don't really know what more she can do in terms of an acting performance. She's going through the mill here. It's a very physical performance. It's like a very emotionally wrought performance. Do you think, I mean, I don't know if she got as recognised for it as she should have done, but I suspect she probably didn't. I'm not a film expert, so I don't know. But it's not something that she's been well awarded for, which I thought was a bit odd, really.
Well, she's having a bit of a renaissance, I'd say, wouldn't you? Like the
Let's look at what else she's been in.
She was in Knives Out. She's good in that.
Oh yeah, that's a good film as well. I enjoyed that. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And she's also in Good Little Miss Sunshine, isn't she?
Yes, yeah. But she's definitely back. She's definitely, maybe she just took a few years out. I mean, that's up to her. I watched an amazing, and I tell you what, I sort of said it at the time, you don't appreciate good acting until you see quite poor acting. I was watching a documentary about the death of, is it JonBenet Ramsey? Do you remember that? Beauty Queen. She's like a young, one of those child beauty queens. It's very creepy to British audiences, but the American, it's a big thing in America. These mums with these ultra competitive mums with big hair, they throw their kids into these kind of beauty competitions, and
it's a bit of a bone of contention in our household, Pete, actually, because my wife's a fan of watching this Toddlers and Tiaras show, which is basically all about that, and I find it exploitative and weird, basically.
Well, you used to be able to watch that on DMAX back in the day until they moved it to another channel. So there you go.
All right.
I think it was DMAX. It was that old challenge. I remember being
TLC
into all of the characters. TLC, right. Okay, yeah. Well, this company, there was this production that I watched. It was fascinating. What they did was they took a load of actors, amateur actors, semi-pro actors in Boulder, who obviously were in the city when the actual murder took place of the child. So all of these kind of amateur actors and basically cast seven versions of the mum, seven versions of the dad, seven versions of the police chief, seven versions of the person who was accused of murdering her, seven versions of the child, and basically kind of told the story from the point of view of actors going into a casting room and reading for the part of the actual character.
Right.
It was a fascinating way to tell a story. It was a little bit kind of reductive because you wanted to see the times when, you know, the parents won Larry King releasing their book and stuff like that. But it was just fascinating to see these kind of like amateur actors who obviously knew a lot about the story because they were in Boulder at the time. They'd had lives around the case, obviously, in Boulder. I've been to Boulder. It's not a big place. It's a kind of university town, I think, for the first. But it was fascinating to sort of see all these people kind of like chewing their way through the scenery. Some decent actors, but mostly poor actors, kind of trying to sort of read for these characters, but also giving their own opinions about what happened at the time when the actual
Where can I watch this, Peter?
You can see it on Netflix. I can't remember what it's called, but hunt it out. It was fascinating. It's a really, really interesting way to do a documentary about something that obviously, I mean, I think she died in the 90s. I imagine there's been a million, billion different documentaries.
We'll try and remember and dig it out because I'll give that a watch for sure. That sounds
interesting. Yes, good.
I wanted to change tack slightly and talk about a story that caught my eye this week as well.
It's called John Bennett. Sorry. John Bennett. There you go.
John
Bennett.
I've seen it on Netflix, actually, advertised, but I've not got around to watching it. I wondered if it was that one. Great. Okay, I'll give it a bash.
Did
you see that the acoustic electric guitar that Kurt Cobain played on his MTV Unplugged performance in 1993?
Oh, yes.
Nirvana Unplugged in New York, sold at auction for $6 million.
I mean, that is that must be the most expensive guitar. I'm sure the Beatles ones have gone.
It's the most expensive guitar ever sold at auction. There's a lot to like about this story because I think his cardigan sold fairly recently for a good amount of money as well. But there's a lot to like about this story. My favourite live album ever. I'll stick that out there. But the guy who bought it is the guy who founded Rode Microphones, Pete.
Oh, nice.
Shout out, Rode.
Shout out, Rode. Exactly. I was sort of thinking under lockdown, Stakhanov must own a lot of Rode stock, not actual stocks and shares, just their stock, really, because we've bought a lot of portable equipment. But
well, for those out there who are listening for this kind of chat, I mean, we split our discipline across Marantz, Neumann, and Rode, but Rode are our tie mic of choice.
Yeah.
So shout out to Peter Friedman, founder of Rode. The good thing about it is I don't know anything about Peter. I'm hoping he's not problematic because it's becoming
it's really hard, isn't it? It's like I really like Dan Electro guitars, but the bloke who owns that company or certainly did a few years ago has some problematic views, so you have a policy of only buying secondhand ones.
Well, Peter Friedman has said that he's going to use the guitar. He's going to tour it around Australia. I believe he's Australian. He's going to tour it around Australia to help raise awareness for lack of arts funding during the COVID epidemic, and that's why he bought it, he said.
Oh, nice!
So, hopefully it goes to good use. But that's a brilliant record. It's just my favorite. It's my favorite live record, and it's not even close. I think it's probably even my favorite Nirvana record. But that's more controversial, and I understand people might have some opinions on that.
I think it's good because it's kind of. I mean, obviously, what was that Scottish band that he covered?
The Vaseline, is that one of my faves as well?
The Vaseline, the song he covered was about a character from Jack and Ori. And like, there's so many different little stories and the stories of actually putting that show together was such a fraught one. Like he was actually quite an antagonistic, kind of difficult, I mean, obviously he fucking was, and he was a heroin addict and you know, all that stuff. But there was rumours that it wasn't going to happen, you know, and it all kind of came together and it became this iconic set and the most important, you would probably say the most important piece of broadcasting MTV's ever done, wouldn't you say?
It certainly is for me. I always point people. I love Nirvana, obviously, because I'm of that age. And to be honest, I didn't really get into them until after Kurt Cobain sadly died, because I was like 13 when he died. But they became a huge part of my musical education as a kid. And I was actually saying this to my wife the other day in the car. I had the Spotify shuffle, and a Silverchair song came on, and I said to Mimi, "I used to love Silverchair back in the day," and it only really kind of occurred to me fairly recently that all the music I liked, well, not all the music, but a lot of the music I liked through the mid to late 90s was essentially a hangover from Nirvana. They were all really sort of poor Nirvana imitations like Bush and Silverchair and one or two others. And so they had a really big impact on me. But I always point people in the direction of a book by a guy called Charles Cross called Heavier Than Heaven. I think he was a childhood friend of Cobain. And it's a really forensic, beautifully written biography of Kurt Cobain. It's so revealing and so interesting. I don't think it's been discredited in the same way that the kind of Brian Wilson one has. But so it's well worth a read. It's called Heavier Than Heaven. If you want to know anything about Cobain and his life and his outlook and his experiences, this is probably as good as you're going to get, I would say. And if anyone else has got a recommendation over and above that, then by all means, kind of email in. But that for me is the definitive one. That record is, everything Nirvana did was just so good, in my opinion, chiefly because even if it's not a particularly individual song that you necessarily like, it's all done with such feeling and such heart, and they mean it. And that sounds cheesy in today's world, but at that point in time, it was really, really important to have that. And to me, it spoke to me a great deal. So, they're a hugely important part of my upbringing, I would say.
Hugely. And the guitar itself, it was like it was an acoustic, had a pickup on it. It wasn't a microphone, was it? It was an actual electric pickup and microphone.
Yeah, basically, that album should just be called, as someone said before, it shouldn't be called Nirvana Unplugged in New York. It should just be Nirvana Slightly Quieter in New York. Because everything is plugged in by the sound of it.
Dave Grohl looks so kind of geeky. He's such a goober. He's in proper, like, seeing Dave Grohl without a beard, you sort of forget that what a goobery kind of chap he had with his. But seeing him use brushes as well kind of really exposes. He's actually a fucking good drummer.
Oh, he's great, Dave Grohl. Great guy. And also, I was going to say to you that for the one thing, that the big poignant thing, apart from the obvious with Nirvana for me, is that after Cobain died, they released that box set with the lights out, and it had an unreleased song on it, the most recent song that Nirvana recorded before Cobain died, and it's called You Know You're Right. And it is so good. It's like legitimately one of their best songs. And you think, my goodness me, he probably had so much more in his tank, like so much more to offer. And so that just makes it especially sad. It's sad because a guy died and because he had depression and because he was a father and all those obvious reasons. But the idea that he probably had an awful lot more to offer creatively as well makes it even more sad, I think. It's just one of those things. But, you know, the most expensive guitar sold in history before that was a Dave Gilmour Fender Stratocaster, apparently, which fetched $4 million for charity in June of last year. So it beat that one by 50%.
Well done. Money, I suppose.
Hopefully it's used for a good cause, and it goes to spread awareness around, you know, financially struggling artists and how important the art sector is in communities and stuff. And I do think there's an element, particularly alongside this political movement that we're currently living through, where everyone knows the price of everything but the value of nothing, and arts funding is really important for lots of different reasons. So if it can go towards that, then great.
Indeed. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with some of your emails, if that's all right with you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Japan-based YouTuber Chris Broad every Wednesday as we offer the lowdown on what's happening in one of the most unique and exciting countries in the world. The Abroad in Japan podcast is home to all things Japan, from things to do...
So today we've come to you guys with 12 places in Japan that nobody knows about.
To the bizarre...
When I moved into my new apartment last year, the police guy came to my door, knocked on my door, I opened it, it was a policeman, and he said to me, in English, I am Japanese policeman. And I went, that's the best introduction you could possibly do as a Japanese policeman.
To the downright filthy.
And for those of you that don't know what a tenga is, Pete and I did discuss how to describe it best before doing the podcast, and I'll let Pete describe what a tenga is. What is it, Pete?
It's a solo male silicon-based ornanist's aid, so to speak.
Brilliant.
New episodes every single Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Abroad in Japan is a Stakhanov production.
And we're back with emails, and they've been flying in, Luke, even
great.
In between all of the stupid spam emails we get from people. Thank you very much.
Still annoyed by that, are you?
A little bit, yeah, because I've got to sift through it, as do you. Hello to Daniel Davis. Hello. He says, not about Japan per se, but I thought you might be interested in the fact that for a long period, glass-making technology was a closely guarded secret in Venice.
Right.
Glassblowers were in fact treated almost as aristocracy because so much of the economy depended on their skills. On the flip side of this, they could not leave Venice because their recipes were so secret, and there are cases of family members being held hostage by the city if any glassblower did actually leave on a trip or try and make a run for it. The implication being, if you tell a secret, your family will pay the price. It was also very common for the glassblowers who also made mirrors to go insane from mercury poisoning. I don't know whether this is directly connected to Japanese glass, but it does show something about the complexities of the process involved. Obviously, the secret did get out. The Venetian economy collapsed and the special glass of the region spread around Europe. Another tale, an interesting tale from the fascinating world of glass. Dan Davis in Lisbon. Thank you very much. Sent from a Huawei mobile, obviously, presumably containing some kind of gorilla glass on the front of it.
Yeah, and that's another reason. Yeah. That story there's another reason why Pete is firmly in the Brexit camp.
Why? What? You shouldn't allow our valuable glass...
Close off the different borders and keep the ideas to ourselves.
Keep the glass in England.
Nothing good has ever happened for the good, conscious sharing of information.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Mate, you mentioned that people can email in, as we say every show, at hello@lukeandpeteshow.com. But our Twitter is @lukeandpeteshow. And the reason I say that is because I saw something on Twitter earlier this week, which made me laugh. And I wondered if the people would have other stories around it of a similar bent. So I don't know about you, Pete. I've never been the member of a golf club. Have you?
No, I've never swung a golf club in anger. Actually, I tell a lie. I have in an urban golf competition that I came last in. I don't really understand it. I had fantasies about turning up at a golf club and being this prodigious talent that had hitherto been undiscovered. But I think we all know that's not the case. So no, I've never been a member of a golf club.
And this is a great bit of Luke and Pete folklore, which I don't think we've mentioned on this show before. You talk about swinging a golf club in an urban golf competition and coming last. I was reading a book about golf once called Bring Me the Head of Sergio Garcia, about a guy who had regrets about not being a pro golfer because he was really good. And at the age of about 30, he goes back into it again. And the final act involves him taking part in this competition of urban golf. He's been invited along, and he ends it by saying, I didn't win it or whatever, but at least I finished so and so shots above XFM's Cheeky Pete. And I was like, how is he in this book? Why is Pete Donaldson now invading the books I'm reading? Your legacy on the golfing front is secured by that alone, Pete. But anyway, so my granddad was a member of a golf club. I spent a bit of time visiting and playing golf with him, but I was never a member. I never really got to know it intimately, and a lot of my friends are members, but I don't really get involved. So, but my impression of golf clubs is exactly how These two people I saw on Twitter tweeted, and it just made me laugh. I don't know them, I don't know either of them, but it's something I saw on Twitter. Yeah. And first guy, Michael, says, "The year is 2020, and I've just been reminded at a golf club that I should be wearing white ankle socks and not black ankle socks. Incidentally, knee-length socks can be any colour but white. The pro kindly let me off this time, but golf clubs don't help themselves." And Jack, this guy called Jack Reeve, replies saying, "I was made to go to the pro shop at Thetford Golf Course in a junior open when I was 14 to purchase new socks as mine were a few millimetres below the ankle."
I just
love it. I just love that there are people at golf clubs who think this stuff is important. There must be loads of our listeners out there who've had a similar experience. I hope there are.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the big stuff like women and black people not being allowed in golf clubs up until, you know, quite recently, to be quite frank. And obviously the people, the dodgy people who own the golf clubs, like the President of America, etc. Like, but ankle socks. Why is anybody policing the ankle socks? It's proper partridge, isn't it?
That's the thing. So what's happened?
Little man in the jeans.
Yeah, there's a chap of about five. The laws have been kind of decided a long time ago, and it does actually really speak to the mentality of certain human beings, because they've just been told that's the rule book. You've got to enforce it, and they'll just blindly do it. And at no point do they stop to think, hang on, it's just, at the end of the day, it's just a pair of socks, isn't it? Like, I mean, it doesn't really matter. Like, no one's really going to care. Like, I understand the rule, like, don't wear your golf shoes in the bar because you're going to scuff up the carpet or you're going to get mud on stuff. And that was the same at the football clubs I was player of. Like, you had to take your boots off before you got into the showers and get and got into the club and all that kind of stuff. I get all that. But, like, certain types of socks, to me, it's such a... They know when people say that the Brits are the kind of administrators of the world. It just really speaks to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also it sort of takes me back to a question we get asked quite a lot on Stakhanov Show abroad in Japan, plugging a lot of other Stakhanov shows at the moment. But we get asked every single week about tattoos in onsens, you know, those hot spring kind of baths you go in. You jump in the hot bath and you jump in the cold bath.
Where that kid waved his willy in your face.
That Chinese child waved his willy in my face. That's correct, yes. Don't want to talk about that. I've already talked about that. The rules are no tattoos. But there is a cultural reason for that, because the only people who had tattoos were criminals. It's changing. Things are getting a little bit more loose. If you're clearly not a member of the Yakuza, like I'm fairly certain that I'm not, the people who sort of judge these very, very harsh... that's exactly what I would say. Yeah. And nobody look at my little finger.
Is that true, by the way, the little finger thing?
Yeah. If you do something wrong, it's
not a myth.
You get a little finger. And there's guys who create... Or you certainly used to create fake little fingers for you, and you'd put a different one on every season to match the tanning, because your hands get tanned in the summer, doesn't it? Don't they? So,
I just like the idea of you becoming like a Yakuza or being like mentioned about doing it or applying or whatever you have to do, and they take you through what happens, and you go, yeah, that's fine, yeah. And by the way, we work these hours, and you're going to be asked to do this, and then if you do something wrong, then we just chop your finger off, and what? Hang on. Let's go back to that bit again, because that sounds a bit much, to be honest.
I think knowing what I'm like, I'd probably just chisel it off before I even applied. I go, look, I'll fuck it up, but I've already done it. So just take that as read. I don't have a thumb. I've taken off a thumb and half a forefinger. Is that all right? That's about my level, okay?
I've got a finger missing. No, it's in my pocket. Anyway, carry on what you were saying. So culturally, like, it's changing because people are more and more. Because when I was a kid, growing up in Portsmouth, it was only really sailors and criminals that had tattoos, really. And now everyone's got them.
And bus drivers.
Yeah. Armed forces people. Yeah, a lot of bus drivers are kind of ex. I mean, my granddad's got a tattoo on his arm, but he got that when he was in the army, and then he became a bus driver. So it does kind of fit. Mm.
Yeah. My dad's got a couple of, I think he's got one of my mum and one of Pisces, and they're I think they're holding up all right, to be honest. They're in the exact same place that I've got my tattoos on the old calves. So but that's all he's really got. He does, as I've said before, he does wear a bone that was removed from his foot around his neck. So he's,
well, hang on a minute. You've never told us that.
I've told you about this.
No, you haven't. There's no one out there that knows this. Tell a story.
I'm trying to think of like weird things, but like, he's pretty normal on the tattoo front, two tattoos, but then when he got a bone taken out of his ankle about 20 years ago, he got it made into, like, he just basically drilled a hole through it and he wears it as a necklace.
Let him keep
like
it.
Some kind of. Yeah, yeah. I think they gave him it in a little jar, but he took it out of the jar. And
who did it? The Doctor on Red Dead Redemption.
it was a Victorian barber surgeon.
Yeah.
Who did it? Yeah. So
listen, Peter. I'm fairly certain, and listeners will correct me if I'm wrong. You have never told me that before.
I think I would have done because you love stories about my dad being weird.
But I would have remembered that. That would be a thing.
Yeah.
That's great news.
I think it's a interesting. It's a bit.
What does your mum think about it?
Who took the years off? Who took the years off?
Yeah. What does Christine think about it?
She wasn't as into it because it was black. It had gone rotten because it was it was a piece of bone that wasn't attached to anything, and that's why it was rattling around his foot and giving him terrible drip. So it was it was absolutely as dark as anything. So he's got this kind of black lump. It almost looks like rock around his neck. So yeah.
And does he always wear it?
Yeah. It never comes off. I started wearing a necklace about sort of December time. A loved one gave me it, and I've not taken it off. I'm loving the necklace life, guys.
Same as me.
It's not a crisis.
My wife got me a necklace with Apollo on it, and I wear that now.
Yeah, I like it.
I've never
worn jewellery before, really.
So just quickly, something that's going to play on my mind otherwise, that it's in Predator, he keeps the skulls, but it's Universal Soldier where the guy keeps the ears.
That is based on
a lot of rumours around what a lot of soldiers were doing in Vietnam. And in fact, I'm fairly certain that when, as a soldier, a member of the services fighting in Vietnam, when you came back after your tour had finished, you weren't allowed to bring anything back at all.
Because people were basically
taking the piss and doing some pretty horrific stuff. So I think it is based. It does sadly does have some kind of basis in truth. But listen, an ankle bone? If it's your own ankle bone, fine. Fill your boots.
Yeah.
With the space you've got, because you've got no ankle bone.
If it's so much, I wonder what's in there. It's just a big gap. Isn't that how like Harley Davidson got its start? Because everyone took their motorbikes home from the Second World War. And then they've kind of like nobody wants to buy Harley Davidsons anymore, so they're in a bit of a weird kind of marketing position. But I think that's why Harley Davidson kind of got its start, because all of the servicemen got their motorbikes, their service motorbikes, cheap, and it kind of built a brand a little bit.
Well, they certainly did build motorcycles for the Americans in World War II. I know that, but I don't know any more than that. It's possible. Maybe people could let us know. Pete, should we wrap up? Because we're running out of time now.
I know, again.
Hello@lukeandpeteshow.com is the place to email in. Tell us about your golf club stories. Tell us about a family member that wears one of his own bones around his neck on a chain, if you like. Love to hear about that. I told you my granddad's bus conductor was the guy who went on to play the bad guy in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, The Running Man. So there's
a little link
for you there. And that's obviously an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie in Predator. So there you go. The circle is complete. We'll be back on Monday for more of this. Hello@lukeandpeteshow.com, @lukeandpeteshow on Twitter. We'll be telling you all about what we got up to at the weekend next week. And we'll speak to you very, very soon. Say goodbye, Pete Donaldson.
The bones are the skeleton's money.
Goodbye from me as well.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.